The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Hi everyone, sorry for the short delay. We just had a couple of small technical issues to deal with. Glad that you could all make it, and I hope you had a pleasant Australia Day weekend. Just going to get straight into it now, and I'd like to ask Marcus Parton to give us a quick rundown on the Shasta Wine Village. Over to you, Marcus.
Hi, and thank you. Yes, we're talking to you from Redding, California, and doing an update on the Shasta Wine Village, located just outside Redding, California, about 4 miles south of the largest lake in California, right along the interstate freeway of Interstate 5 that runs up all the way from Mexico to Canada, and then intersects also with the east-west highways, providing access to about 2.7 million visitors a year into the region, and about 830,000 travelers a month. So we're updating on what's going on with the Shasta Wine Village and its development, which has been 4 years in planning and approvals, was approved about a year ago and went into pre-development planning, which means architectural plans for approval to get it to the point of building permits. Part of that has been grading plans, and so we'll go over the current status of that project.
Hey, Marcus, this is Kathy. I just want to jump in. We wanted to, you know, we show these groups indications, you know, every I don't know 4 or 5 months, and we've been offering this for a while, and thought it would be really useful and valuable to let you know how these different group projects are coming along. And so this is why we're having Marcus present this. It's already been sold out for a while, but Marcus did just open up one of his own shares. So there is availability still for very, 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 very limited if you are interested. So be sure to contact me at Kathy, K-A-T-H-Y, Kathy at realwealthnetwork.com, but of course here's the update so you can see if you would like to be interested in this project, which is really, really exciting for California. California is obviously known for its wine, as are you in Australia, but it's growing very quickly in California, and we get the chance to participate in this commercial project called the Shasta Wine Village, where we'll be leasing out tasting rooms to some of the many wineries that want this exposure on a very, very, very busy freeway in Northern California. So, all right, back to you, Marcus. Just want to make sure everybody knew what was going on.
Oh, sure, and thanks, Kathy. You know, from a clarification standpoint, we had two master LLC units that were left after all the other funding was done. One of those is gone, one's remaining, and that is it when it's subscribed. That's our full offering. So as kind of an update, you know, California, of course, has 90% of the wine here, and it's very exciting as typified by what happens this week. Unified Wine Symposium is in Sacramento, where they'll have 14,000 winemakers from all over the world, and this is our fourth year there. You know, they've seen how Shasta Wine Village has evolved, because it is a unique concept where you have a combination of individual wine rooms. In California, individual licensed wineries can have one other tasting room anywhere else they want in the state, and it becomes a part of the winery. So it's important for a region such as ours and the surrounding regions that are more spread out geographically, that they have access to their key consumers. And so that was the market, and that's the reason we saw it from a real estate standpoint, the upside, because it produced a lot more rental income than regular retail of a similar nature. So not only do we have Unified, which is about 14,000 people coming in, and they're about building their brands. So sometimes what they pay in rental doesn't necessarily have to equate to same retail dollars. Also, you see the boom in wine tourism that it takes advantage of, where wine tourists in California have exceeded 21 million a year now, and this next year, 2015, the wine tourism conference is in its fifth year, and we'll be attending, where communities and wineries are taking advantage of that tourism, because it's led to that increase in wine, direct wine sales, which has gone up every year for the last 10 and is projected to continue. So getting to the Wine Village real quick and what's taken place on that and how it's at where we're at since our last update. You know, we planned 16 to 19 individual rooms. Many of them are already secured, plus two dining facilities, two restaurants, and a 65,000 square foot event area. In the event area planning, as an example, it took longer getting that approval, but it was important for the wineries because they need a place, since they're open 7 days a week, to have special events. From our standpoint, from a real estate standpoint, that was its own profit center as a rental venue for weddings and celebrations and things like that. So as you look at this site now, what's taken place recently is we're looking at the with the approvals that we'll be able to open up two of the buildings prior to the other two buildings opening up if need be. The county, who is the governmental body that gave us our approval, saw that we have two entrances on major roadways, and we're located right at a freeway interchange, and so they'll allow us to open up a portion of those if it helps us. That's not a delay in it, because we've had pent-up demand for years waiting to come in. So that's moved ahead rapidly. We had a groundbreaking that took place on the site, and this picture doesn't show as much substantial grading has been taking place, but there was over 2 months of earthwork that was done on the site. So running through the steps as a quick update, it's a 10-acre site. We've now completed the preliminary grading on it. And that was important. It was stressed to us by our general contractor that because of the rainy season, which usually hits in this area between November and March, that if we got significant rains in the area, it could hold up construction until as late as July. So it was important for us to get that done, and we worked with the county. They offered us a grading permit with our plan and made those substantial cuts. Even though it backs up to a hillside and the site looks relatively flat, we have certain accessibility issues from one building to another that had to be addressed, and the grading took care of that. We had underlying financing because these properties were the assemblage of three different properties that were originally acquired in 2006. Two of the three have now been paid off. We elected to get into our grading plan and utilize funds for that. So I think there's an underlying balance of just about $200,000, and that's completely paid off. So the property's absolutely free and clear with all its entitlements, and that was the plan in our offering. We, on December 30th, we made formal applications and had applications accepted by the county for our building permits. And this is an important next step, that they receive our plans, which had to be in acceptable format. Then they go through and do what's called redlining those, where they'll go through, clarify anything that needs to be done, make sure that it's consistent with the approvals that we have, and get us to the point of building permit approval, which is anticipated now within the next 60 days.
Wonderful.
Part of that planning has allowed for us to, a lot of times, the space allocation of building commercial space, which helps determine how much rents we get, we're able to lease out for, is based upon how many parking spaces there are by code. We actually have 160 parking spaces on this site, and the facility is designed to accommodate first year 48,000 visitors. So the allocation of an additional 1,200 square feet to retail from warehousing means more rentals for us, and we were able to make that final tweaking modification. And finally, the last thing we're doing, in fact, we had a meeting on that today with the architect and planning, is the pavilion, stage, event area, bridges, and utility buildings are now in their final design. Everything else has been designed and in for approval on the site. These are the final stage, and most of this will be submitted by next Friday. So it's moving ahead very rapidly. And finally, as we go back real quick, we're doing that shift now from planning and planning approval to marketing. The regions, as I said, are surrounding the Shasta Cascade region. The wine region's 186 miles north to south. The surrounding regions are similar, that they're hard to get to. They're not close to public transportation corridors. They don't have things like hotels and restaurants readily accessible, where all those things are right here in Redding. We have almost 3,000 hotel rooms. They're building more. But the services are here, and there's other reasons for visitors to attend. So it's great in its design, and now we plan on going into the marketing where we look at wineries, larger wineries from outside regions. As an example, the Lodi region has some of the same characteristics, and yet they produce more of most types of grapes grown in California than anywhere else, including Napa and the Sonoma regions. So what that'll do is that'll take some initial rendering designs, and these were done quite a while ago, but they give a general indication of building size, not the exact look of what these buildings are going to look like, along with our entrance from our main arterial roadway, which actually goes past a working vineyard, which will be on site, to our other frontage road that parallels the interstate freeway for our other access point. So those will be changing, and now that we have architectural drawings done, those go to a planner and go to a 3D format where prospective tenants can actually look at the site and get a real exact feeling of where everything is. And we're able to produce marketing materials that look more like this, as an example, where these are actual renderings, but it gives a look and feel of what the development will look like when it's done. These are examples from actually people that are in the process of doing the work. So we have it's an exciting time for us, because we've gotten to the point now where building permits are closed. We've had a lot of outstanding press. In this region, everybody knows about the Shasta Wine Village. We have a website, ShastaWine.com, and we're on Facebook with followers. But the excitement has grown in this area. There was just a few weeks ago a recent front page article about how the Shasta Wine Village is on track and the winery excitement. Tied in with, spoke a week and a half ago before the as a keynote speaker before the Viticulture Association for the region, giving them the strong update of, you know, this is the year. It's coming out of the ground, and a lot of excitement for it. So that's your update, Kathy. That's where we're at with the Shasta Wine Village.
Okay, wonderful. Let me just see if there's any questions. John, are you able? I don't see any. Okay. So, again, this is a project that, again, we sold out. We raised the $3 million, and now there's one share left on Marcus's side that was reserved for his investors, and one of those is already sold, and there's one left. So if anybody's interested in this project, it's kind of a nice investment for you as Australians, because you don't have to come to the U.S. You don't have to open a bank account or get an LLC or do any of that. You don't have to manage a property or manage your property managers. It's just all done for you. You can wire your funds over through Oz4X and know that it's all being managed by Marcus and his team, and it's going to be a really well-known project in California. It's already getting a lot of media attention, and you know, obviously people come to California to taste wine, just like we come to Australia to taste yours. And they literally do these wine tours of these different places, and certainly the Shasta Wine Village is going to be on that list, not to mention all the tourists that are up there anyway for Shasta Lake, which is just a gorgeous lake up there, and now a very soon-to-be famous winery, or I'm sorry, wine tasting room. So, and you all have probably seen this in touristy areas. You're seeing more and more tasting rooms show up in areas where people can sample the local wines. And that what's so unique about this one is it's right off the major Highway 5 freeway that goes all the way through the state into Oregon. So I don't see any questions, so I think he answered it all.
Great, and if there is, if they could get a hold of you, Kathy, that would be perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, just reach out, Kathy, Kathy, at realwealthnetwork.com. So, good. Well, thank you, Marcus. Have a great evening.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you, Marcus.
Okay, thanks. Bye now.
So we're going to, if you switch control back to me, John, that would be great. I was just going to give a really quick forecast for the U.S. housing market in 2015. I don't know if any of you got the chance to see it. I just did this last Thursday, but I'm going to present it again because I think it's important to really understand what's happening in the U.S. housing market and how you can still make money or not. So we'd rather you make money. So just real quickly, the U.S. GDP, our gross domestic product, was revised three times, and some say the numbers are cooked, but they always are. Hey, we're dealing with the government, right?
Yeah.
They're saying.
Sorry, Kathy. I've just got a blank screen at the moment. I've changed to you.
Oh. Huh. It says that it's showing. You don't see anything?
No, just a black screen.
Interesting.
I am showing up great on my end here, Kathy.
You're seeing it?
I'm seeing it, yes. I made it to Florida. I must have not made it to Australia.
That's a bit odd. It might be just me, it seems, judging from the comments I'm getting. That's interesting.
Nobody else can see it? Or they
No, I've got it now. It's okay now. I've got it now.
Okay. Okay, all right. We'll just move through this quickly. Basically, it's looking like the U.S. economy is certainly doing better than it was moving forward, and these are positive numbers. And with the positive growth of the economy, that means jobs. Jobs, we have the best year for increased employment since 1999, so lots of new jobs. The unemployment rate down to 5.6%. Number of unemployed declined 1.1%. It's 1.7 million people now employed. So basically, this is very, very different news than you first heard when we first started working with you at Cashflow USA, when it was the opposite. We were losing jobs and people were, the unemployment was increasing and that's all turning around. And we care about that a lot because we want our tenants to have jobs and pay us money, be able to afford our rent. So let's move to affordability. This is a study based on Realty Track. 475 counties, which is about 70% of the U.S. population, we saw incomes rose just 1.8% nationally, so nothing fantastic, but at least it's a positive number. Affordability levels at 26% of average income compared to 41% at the peak. So it's still pretty affordable out there. Some markets are not, but overall, it's because of the low interest rates that the affordability is still there. Now, 21% of those counties were less affordable than their average. So that would be New York City, San Francisco, San Jose, LA, Orange County, Boston. These are all very desirable coastal cities. These other areas aren't used to being unaffordable, but 12% of the counties were over their peak levels, and this was surprising. Austin, Atlanta, Charlotte, Raleigh, New York City, Rochester, New York. If you were familiar with us back in 2010, you knew that we were bullish on Atlanta and Charlotte and Raleigh because these were great markets, but now the prices have gone up so much, Austin, Texas, that it's just not a deal anymore. It's just not great, and that's why you're not seeing these cities on our best markets pages at Real Wealth Network. But 48% of the counties are still historically affordable, and these are the areas we're focused on helping investors buy in because the prices haven't jumped up yet, and there's reasons for that I'm going to go into a minute. But Cincinnati, Dayton, Pittsburgh, Chicago, Indianapolis, these are still very affordable areas and very good places to invest. So let's talk about why. The supply inventory levels fell 6% to a five-month supply nationwide. When we have low inventory levels like that, prices drive up. Also, we're getting so much good news, headline news about real estate, that people are in a better mood to buy it, so they are. There's this lack of building that happened over the last 6 years, so we really fell behind on building new homes. So that, affects supply. And some existing inventory we're expecting will hit the market as prices continue to rise and people are able to sell their homes, they're not underwater anymore, but that hasn't happened a lot. So then where's the demand coming from? You know, a lot of people are saying it's these millennials. It's 42% of millennials who are, you know, 35 and under, they want to buy. And, you know, you've all heard about the baby boomers, of course. Well, they, you know, I'm one of them. We all had kids, and our kids now are a larger demographic than we were. So this, the largest demographic in the U.S. is these 23-year-olds. I have a 22-year-old, so she's right in there. The next largest group is 24 and then 22. Now, I don't think these kids are looking to buy, but they will. And we want to keep an eye on them because their impact on our economy is going to be huge, just like the baby boomers boom. Now, just a few years ago, we were talking about how investing in homes in college towns was important because there was such demand. Well, this is why. The largest generation population in the U.S. were these college kids. You know, so colleges were thriving. They were raising their rates. That's all going to change as these kids, you know, there's smaller populations going to colleges. We're going to see those prices drop, and we're going to keep an eye on college towns and what's happening there. But we've got to follow this age group. And the real question is, when are they going to start buying homes? If we as investors can buy properties that they're going to rent right now and hold those until they're ready to buy, then we're really going to see huge demand in real estate and prices increasing at crazy levels once this group is ready to buy. But for now, they're renting, which means that rents are guaranteed to continue to go up because this is a huge population in the U.S. They're getting employed. They're getting out of college. They're moving out. They're creating household formations. So they're driving two-thirds of the new household formations in the U.S., which is currently at around 500,000. 1 million would be considered robust. So we're halfway there, and that's just going to continue as the economy improves. Now, the only thing that we need to notice is that these kids aren't getting married right away, and they're not starting families right away, and they've got a bunch of student loan debt. So, again, we've got to pay attention to when they're going to be ready to buy property, but in the meantime, they are our renters, and that's great. Now, 31% of Gen X, 35 to 50, they want to buy. A lot of these people got hit hard by the housing recession we just had, so that's why the number's lower. They may have just gone through a foreclosure, so they may not be in the biggest hurry to go do it again, but 31% of them are. And we're seeing investors back off a little, just down to 15% of buyers, but this is just data that's coming to us through the National Association of Realtors, and they're only really tracking what's put on the MLS. And I could tell you, investors aren't always buying properties on the MLS. They are, our group, for example, Real Wealth Network, those properties are not on the MLS that our investors buy. So that number's not really accurate, but we're still at least seeing investor purchases on the MLS is down. Okay, so real estate prices, what's happening in the U.S., well, home values overall, nationwide, total, have increased $1.7 trillion to $27.5 trillion. Now, where else do you see trillion-dollar gains in 1 year in an asset class where that's just 1% of the total? So, you know, real estate is a huge asset class in the U.S. It's why the government cares. That's why we have such good programs and all these, you know, why the interest rates have been held low for so long and so forth, all these programs to the 30-year fixed rate mortgage, because the government obviously sees the value of real estate in the U.S. So national home prices are up 6.7%. That was 8% last year. So increase in home prices is slowing down, but still positive. But certain areas had higher appreciation, Miami, Atlanta, Houston, Orlando, San Jose, California. These are all double-digit areas. Interestingly enough, nationally, home prices are at spring of 2005 levels. Now, if you look back, that was right before we had a major collapse in housing at that time. So that was a time when we were kind of moving into a bubble. So the question is, are we in a bubble? We already know that salaries didn't really go up that much, so can home prices continue to go up? And so most people are saying, nah, you know, we're probably going to see just a, you know, 4% appreciation this year in the national, at the national level. Freddie Mac says 3.5%. You get lots of different feedback, but the bottom line is there is no such thing as a national housing market. There's no flat number. Each market is going to behave differently, and so we want to know, where's that next market that's going to give us double-digit returns, right, on appreciation and cash flow? So what we've been trying to tell everybody is that you're going to get those gains in the judicial foreclosure states in the U.S. So to explain what that means, judicial foreclosure means that when a property is getting foreclosed, it has to go through a judge. It has to go into the court system. And we just didn't have enough judges to handle the massive foreclosures. So the states that go this way, and not the trust deed states like California, the judicial states still have a backlog of foreclosures. So that's not good for their housing market, but it's really, really good for us as investors who are still looking for good deals. So if you were trying to find bargains and you missed out on 2009, 2010, 2011, when you could, you know, just get a half, you know, a property for half what it was before, there are some areas where you can still do that. So that's really exciting. We're going to talk about where in just a minute. So home prices, again, are now 5% from their 2007 peak. So we're really getting close nationally to, you know, to a peak market. 1.5 million borrowers returned to positive equity, meaning their home values went up enough that they're higher than the loan, and that's great. However, 10% of borrowers are still underwater. That's about 5 million, mostly borrowers under 40. Remember that group I said isn't really excited about buying right now because they either got foreclosed on or they're still underwater, and that's been rough. But the areas with the highest equity where the prices have gone up the most, California, New York, and Hawaii, of course, the coastal states that have always been, always had these, you know, highs and lows. It's just the way it goes. Areas that have the highest negative equity still, meaning loans are still way higher than the home values, Nevada, Florida, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. So still some trouble in those states. But trouble in those states, trouble in housing, you know, that's an opportunity for investors. So let's talk about that. Foreclosures, again, down 29% from last year. Last year was down like 30% from the year before. So we're really at the lowest level of foreclosure activity since 2006, before the mortgage crisis even happened. So really down to very few foreclosures. If you want a foreclosure, you've got to know where to go to get one, because in most states, it's over. There are still 643,000 properties in the process, but that's a 70% drop from the 2009 peak of 2.1 million. Out of that, only 327,000 actually foreclosed, so a 69% drop since the 2009 peak of 1 million. So again, expect fewer distressed properties in the trust deed states where a foreclosure happens fairly quickly, and know that you can get still great deals in these judicial states, which is why we keep telling you guys, now's the time. It's going to be over soon. Prices are going to be too high. Cash flow's gone. But, you know, right now in these states, you can still buy cheap, get cash flow, and just watch the values go up. So, again, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida, Indiana, parts of New York and New Jersey. We like these areas. All right, interest rates. What's going to happen? Well, the Federal Reserve's already said they're not going to raise the Fed fund rate in the first half of the year, Q1 or Q2. So interest rates are going to stay low for the first half of the year. But most people are expecting they're going to go up a little bit after that. So what does that mean? Well, it means that probably as rates, they probably won't go over 5%, but eventually they will. And so as rates go up, affordability is going to go down, and the home price appreciation is going to slow down. So again, you've got like 6 months to get some good deals, and really you don't want to be buying in the spring when everybody else is. Now, right now is really the time to buy U.S. real estate if you were thinking about it. You just might miss out if you wait too long. Are we creating another bubble from these low interest rates? Absolutely. The high-priced markets, we believe, are in a bubble. That would be California. That would be those high-priced markets I said, California and, you know, New York City and Seattle and Atlanta, some of these areas where the prices went up so much. There's probably a bubble, and we're probably going to see price decline. So be careful in those areas. Before buying any property, just check and see what the value was in 2006. And if you're paying more than our last bubble, you're probably paying bubble prices again. So rates will eventually increase. So calculate payments at 6% interest rate just to determine if it's affordable for the area. And then you can look up the average income and the average ability for people to pay. And if you're above that at 6%, you're going to see some trouble. And again, that's why we like these affordable markets where the prices haven't gone up yet and where interest rate increases are really not going to affect those areas because there's so much room there. For example, you know, gosh, in Ohio, you could still have a mortgage payment that's $300 or $400, but the rent is $900 a month. So people can afford a higher mortgage payment. They just maybe can't get the loan, but eventually they can. And if interest rates go up, those areas just aren't going to be affected. I hope that makes sense. I'm going to go over this really quickly because it doesn't really apply to you. Just simply that you don't have to worry so much about another market crash in the U.S. I get asked that question all the time. You know, if we're at bubble prices, are we going to see a massive crash like we did in 2009? And that's a scary thought. But here's my thought about it. No, we're really not, because the last 6 years, it's been almost impossible to get a loan in the U.S. These laws passed, the QM, the qualified mortgage, and ATR, the ability to repay. These are things that rules that banks have to follow. If they follow them, then they're not going to have to buy back the loan if the loan goes bad. So banks aren't messing around. They are making sure the borrower knows is able to pay. And because of that, we're just really not going to see loans go bad unless we just had a terrible turn in our economy and everybody lost their jobs. But it just doesn't appear to be heading in that direction. We, in fact, seem to be expanding. And we sure as heck better be after the trillions of dollars we've put into our economy. If we can't expand at a 3% GDP, then, you know, that's just sad. But we are, thankfully. And the other thing is banks are not doing no interest, loans and those balloon loans and all those crazy, you know, stated income loans and no income, no asset loans. Those just aren't happening anymore and haven't for the last 6 years. So we're not going to have the subprime crisis that we had that brought down the U.S. housing market. So don't worry about that. But I do think there are areas where people overpaid, they got in a frenzy, and they're going to see prices go down. But if you've been following us, you're not going to be one of those people, because I doubt you bought in San Francisco or New York City or Seattle, you know, or again, Austin. Okay, so home construction. Home construction, this matters because we want to know how much new inventory is coming on the market that might also affect pricing. In December, home starts were the highest they were in 6.5 years, but that doesn't mean that it's all better. 1.5 million new homes is what's considered needed to keep up with population decay. During the Great Recession, we were only building about 500,000 each year, so a million short every year for 6 years. That's quite a shortage of homes. Now, you might be saying, well, didn't you overbuild before that? And we did. In 2005, we overbuilt, but only by 500,000. So we're really, really behind on new home construction. The only reason why that hasn't really hit yet is there's still this household formation problem where kids are still living with their parents and people moved in with friends and stuff. But as they get out there and they get hired and they get their jobs and stuff and they move out, we're going to have 3 to 5 million households formed and just not the properties for them. So that's and they're most likely going to be renters. So that's good for us as landlords. So again, just home construction has been slow, and yet our population is growing by 4.5 million every year. We have 3 to 5 million people who moved in with mom and dad who are going to be moving out. So we're going to see huge demand for rentals and for first-time home buyers at probably about 2 years from now. Okay, commercial. What's going on in commercial? You know, we just talked about the Shasta Wine Village, and that's one of our commercial projects we're excited about. But as the economy improves, so does commercial, because more businesses thrive, right, in a good economy. So we're finding good deals out there. We're keeping you on top of it. We just closed out a North Dakota commercial project. However, I talked to Ron today, and we actually have a couple of spaces left in that project because we can only have 25% of the funds that come in can be in self-directed IRAs, which is our retirement funds over here. So we hit that max, and we had to turn away some of the U.S. investors who were planning to use their self-directed IRAs. They can't use their retirement funds. So we have four slots that opened up, and that's a really wonderful commercial project in North Dakota in the oil boom area. And if you're interested in knowing more about that, go to realwealthnetwork.com and look at the most recent blog I wrote on the oil boom in North Dakota. You have probably been seeing some negative headline news about it, but that is all just that's just drama from the news. We've seen the five largest oil companies in the world invest $105 billion in the region right near our project in just the last 5 years. So they're not investing $105 billion, including Warren Buffett, who we don't know how much she put in, but it's a lot. They're not going to just walk away because of political warfare or economic political warfare. They're going to fight this battle and not give up. So we're not worried. We think it's a really exciting project, and you can get more information there at realwealthnetwork.com and click on the blog. But other good tenants are healthcare, because you got the aging baby boomers, high tech, of course, and that's why we love Pennsylvania. There's a lot of high tech going on there. Higher education is good. Another reason Pennsylvania is a great state, because there's so many colleges there. Energy and energy transportation, these are great commercial tenants to have. So we think the best strategy for you as Australians is to invest in a group project that's managed by somebody with tremendous amount of experience. We like to say 30 to 40 years experience, because that way you can just know that you're invested in a great project and you don't really have to worry about it being so far away from the deal. You know, it's just nice to know. And those are our highest yielding deals. I mean, people come to us all the time and say, can we still get 20% returns on U.S. property? And the answer is yes, if you can finance it. And we do have financing for you, so ask us about that for sure. You can, again, reach out to Kathy, K-A-T-H-Y, at realwealthnetwork.com, and we'll send you some lenders that are now lending to, they're doing commercial blanket loans to foreign investors. So that's exciting. But if you just really want something totally passive, that has the higher yield, 20% or more, these syndications are the way to go. A syndication just means a group investment, meaning that, you know, for the North Dakota project, we needed to raise $5 million to acquire the land and you know, get that project started. So, you know, 92 investors came in with $50,000 each, and all together, you know, bought that project and own it together, and it's managed by a developer who's been doing the exact same type of commercial projects for 40 years, you know, so he knows what he's doing, and that's really gives people a lot of comfort. Certainly, it does me. All right, so let's talk. We talked a little bit about the rents in the U.S. and how those are going to go up. On average, they've gone up 6% year over year. We tend to calculate our performance with 4%, so that's pretty good. That means you get a 6% raise every year. In some areas, it's even higher than that. And I already said there's this shadow demand of 3 to 5 million Americans, you know, looking to move back out and now getting jobs. So they're going to be our renters. Average rents, again, increasing 4 to 7% or 4 to 8%. But in these big cities, it's crazy. The rents eat up 49% of their income and more. Over 30% is considered unaffordable. So, you know, those are not great markets to try to get cash flow in. But in cash flow markets, expect rents to climb. So you have this opportunity right now to still buy in the judicial states for cheap, while knowing that rents are going to continue to rise and home prices too. So Still just about a 6-month window of really great opportunity here in the U.S., and I hope you don't miss out just because you wait too long, okay? oops, that was our last event. Don't need to say anything about that. So does anybody have any questions about this, what I just went over?
There was just one question, Kathy.
If you are interested in any of those markets? Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry, there was just one question that popped up. I don't know if you saw it on your screen. It was just about whether foreign aliens can get loans, mortgage loans. Is that still not possible in the U.S.?
No, no, it is. It is. It's very exciting. There's okay, you know that hedge funds were buying U.S. property like crazy. And then they stopped because they maxed out. And now they're lending. Now many of those companies have turned to lending. And we have several who are happy to lend to our foreign investors. And the rates really aren't that bad. They're, I don't know, 5 or 6%. And they're blanket loans, which means that it's a commercial loan. So maybe you have 5 properties you paid cash for. They'll come and give you a blanket loan on all 5 of those properties. And I think even with just 25 or 30% equity, they'll lend you the rest, and the rates are really good. So there definitely is lending now for you guys, and that's just so exciting, especially, like I said, if you already have bought property for cash and you want to leverage those properties and get some cash out and buy more, that's one way you could do it. But it also works on purchase loans as well.
Yeah, some of them, like B2R, for example, I think was one of the organizations that were doing that, and they had a $500,000 minimum. I think they were lending on portfolios between $500,000 and $2 million from memory. Is that changing? Are those limits still there? Is it possible to buy a single home with a loan?
No, not with those commercial loans. I think, I don't know if Ron, are you on? I actually think that some of our people do have that. I think North Dakota single family homes has it. And I believe possibly in some of the other markets. So if you're interested in financing a single family home, just reach out again, Kathy at realwealthnetwork.com, and we'll send you the list of lenders that might work for you.
Can you hear me?
Hey, Ron. Hey, yeah, thank you. I can't remember. It changes all the time, but where are we getting lending?
Yeah, we're also seeing it in Dallas. They have it for nationals there, but you'll need to speak with our provider there because they have specific programs for individuals. You said North Dakota already, correct?
Yes.
Okay. North Dakota, I think those two are top of mind. I think there's one other one, but I'll have to come back to everybody.
Yeah, I think Chailey might have some too. So so just reach out. If you're looking to get financing, we'll make sure we reach out to all of our affiliates and find out who's got it, because again, that changes every day. All right, any other questions?
Just one of the students has asked if we can have another webinar on foreign national loans or an update. So, maybe plan something like that in the future.
Yeah, we'll do that. We'll do that next month for sure.
Yeah. Other than that, there was just one person who's probably going to be in touch with you about getting a list, and I'll probably send you an email as well just to get a list of lenders, just so that I've got it for myself.
Okay, wonderful. Thanks. All right, and we've got Larry who's got an update too. Do you want to run that from my computer? Larry, did you want to do it from yours?
I can do it from mine.
Okay, great.
Okay, yes. Thanks very much for that, by the way.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm just finding it now, Larry. Will only be a minute. Are you there?
No worries. Yep, I'm here. I'm watching it switch gears.
Okay.
Wonderful, wonderful. I got it. Yeah, these slides are actually just almost pretty much a reiteration of what Kathy had talked about. And the next three slides are really pretty much talking about the huge rental demand that is going on in the U.S. right now. And like say, Kathy touched on it, but these first couple slides are from FRED, which basically is your Federal Reserve Economic Data Organization. And the underlying really speaks, you know, volumes. It says the U.S. is facing a new housing crisis. Again, Kathy kind of touched on that. You know, the time the nation is dealing with shortages of rentals, a problem that will become increasingly acute in the years to come. It says the population is growing, and there's just a large number of people moving out. We call them basement kids, moving out of mom and dad's basement and getting jobs. In fact, the number one group in the country that are getting good high-paying jobs are the baby boomers. So you're going to hear, I'm sorry, not the baby boomers, the millennials. So you're going to hear a lot about millennials there and how they're going to basically be the driving force in your rentals over the next, you know, handful of years while they continue to become a strong marketplace folks out there. In America, there's simply just not really enough homes to accommodate the population needs. Builders are having trouble finding lots and land. Where they do find land, they're not able to build the large complexes and volume of single-family homes that they have in the past. So it has becoming kind of an issue where we just don't have the room for the housing, and that's going to create a supply and demand imbalance, obviously in favor of the landlord, which is kind of cool. The graph there basically shows you very much how the new privately owned housing units completed are just definitely dropping. So we have a large need for rentals, and we just do not have the housing supply for that. You can move on to the next slide. Here's another good one. This slide actually only goes to the year 2012, but you'll see about 2009 that vacancy rates, that's when we were in the heart of our recession, vacancy rates are pretty high in the 10% category, dropped way down to 8.6 in 2012, but continued down, I believe Kathy highlighted at like 5.9. So the vacancy rates are very, very low. I think most of those vacancy rates pretty much consist of, you know, people moving out and in the transition to their new homes. So the vacancy rates are very low, again, showing a nice supply and demand balance in favor of the landlord. And this is kind of interesting. This here is a Google search over time. Obviously, it goes up and down because here in the U.S., you know, winter months, typically there is less moving activity, but in the summer months it peaks. But you look at the midline there, obviously the Google searches have definitely been on the rise. So between these few slides and everything Kathy says, there's one thing you can be certain about in the U.S. is there's definitely some need for housing. In fact, over the last couple of years, the housing ownership has dropped by about 7%, and they pretty much forecast that that's probably going to stay about there because that is kind of historic average. Where we're at right now is historic average. During the boom years, they were giving loans to pretty much anyone who could fog a mirror. That isn't happening now, so we definitely have a large need for rental housing, and of course that's what we're talking about here at Castle USA. To reiterate that. And that's all I have, folks, but I wanted to just kind of reiterate that huge rental need.
Well, thanks very much, Larry. There's been no more questions, so we're going to finish a little bit early, which is a little bit unusual, but there you go. Anyway, thanks very much to Kathy and to Marcus, Larry, Ron, everyone connected with it. Appreciate your time, and I hope everybody enjoyed it. Thanks very much for listening. We'll catch you all again, guys.
All right. Thank you.